Hey, this is David Rovix with another episode of Discussions with David. Since the pandemic hit and made touring and performing impossible, I've taken to broadcasting interviews with people who I can't visit in person anymore. They're live streamed most weekdays at 10 a.m. Actually, I've changed that to most pretty much Tuesdays and Wednesdays, occasionally other days, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Western European time on various platforms, including the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance and KABU Community Radio here in Portland, Oregon. All these interviews also then go out in podcast form afterwards, which you can find if you look up This Week with David Rovix on any podcasting platform, or just go to davidrovix.com. I also do a live concert from my living room on the last Saturday of each month, which is at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. in Belfast, 10 p.m. in Berlin, at the last Saturday of each month. Today, we're spending the hour with longtime activist and blogger from North Belfast on the island known as Ireland, from the region of the island known to some as Northern Ireland, known to others as the North of Ireland, and still others as the occupied six counties. Fra Hughes, welcome to my live stream show. Great to have you. Fra, I know that you read a piece that I wrote recently and published in various places, Escalation in Portland. And it is a particular moment, it seems, over here where it's no longer safe. There's always elements of risk in anything, but it's basically like the general feeling was that going to a protest was not usually going to be a matter of taking your life into your hands. And I think there was a point in the history in the north of Ireland there when people started realizing very quickly that it was no longer safe to be just having a march or something, because after Bloody Sunday and after the pogroms, and not that we're having pogroms on that level, the people going around burning hundreds of houses of other residential neighborhoods, that's not happening at this point here. But people are getting shot going to protests and getting hit by yahoos and pickup trucks with big American flags who run into crowds and that sort of thing. It's a changing situation. Just wonder what you have. So, it's a random place to start talking to somebody in Belfast, Ireland, but I just wonder if we might just start with some observations of what's been going on over here in Portland and in the United States lately.
Yeah, well, every conversation or random conversation must start somewhere. I find what you wrote very, very, very interesting, mainly because from afar it looks like America to me, from, you know, our civil rights protests that started in 1969, which kind of led very much into the Troubles or the National War of Liberation, depending on people's viewpoint. It lasted for over 25 years. It started out as a call from civil society to the state to reform from being, in our case, discriminatory against the Roman Catholic, Irish, national, indigenous population. And looking from, so we kind of took our lead from the civil rights movements, from not necessarily the Panthers, I don't know, you know, the time scale of when people all came together, but, you know, Mississippi burning, the lynchings, the call by the Black Americans for basic justice and to be treated with equality within the American state system, you know, saying we are huddled masses and we will give them freedom and justice and democracy. And it appears
like in the late 60s, like the civil rights movement in Ireland in the late 60s. Yeah,
absolutely. Yes, our civil rights very much mirrored, in my opinion, the civil rights leaders in North America, because it's the same kind of struggle. You know, it's a repressed class that's treated as a second-class citizen by their own judiciary, by their own administration, by their own political leaders. So, like, we went from civil rights to a kind of civil war between the Irish and the British in this part of the island. And for me, from the outside, it looks very much as if America is following, not us the way we followed you, but there seems to be a pattern of the repression of civil rights. I mean, the Black African Americans appear to have gained absolutely nothing from the Obama administration, from the Democratic Party in 30, 40, 50, 60 years. There appears from the outside to be absolutely have been no progressive movement on the rights of black people from the American political system. So yeah, it looks like you've had the civil rights in the 60s that have led to, you know, civil disorder, which has come from the continued brutalization and murder of black American Africans. And it looks to me from the outside that you're moving one step closer to, you know, civil rights, civil disturbance, civil war, because you have a president who is saying Black Lives Matter are really Antifa and anarchists. Now, these groups may well have a political alignment of truth and justice for African Americans, but the Black Lives Movement, to me, is not Antifa. It's not an anarchistic organization. So your president at this moment in time is demonizing the Black Lives Movement, and it's creating this division between white America, supremacist right-wing America, the Trump supporters, and the Republicans, and basically nearly every other section of society, because there are progressive white people, there are progressive Hispanics, there are progressive Asians who are all supporting what Black Lives Matter. The real crux of this whole situation is about equality and justice within the American capitalist system. And so long as the American capitalist system cannot give this justice and equality for all the people within society, you will have a them and us division. And to me, it's not just America. We now have the Irish Freedom Party, which mm-hmm. is a right-wing, like English Defence League, Tommy Robinson type right-wing fascist grouping, using the COVID-19 as a cover for how the government is, taking away our rights as individuals. I mean,
is this on both sides of the border there in Ireland? Because I always have said that in the Republic, at least, it's the only place in Europe that doesn't have an organized right wing. Yes, I mean, in terms of far right.
It may. Yeah. It depends on your definition of far right. I mean, there's far right. Are we talking about a violent far right? We're talking about the far right that comes out onto the street, gives Nazi salutes, uses nationalism as a crux for their racism in order to recruit naive people believing they're fighting for some form of patriotism, and in reality they're fighting for a form of fascism. We in our history, after the War of Independence, we had a civil war between the Republicans, who wanted to continue the struggle and liberation for Irish liberation from British military occupation.
For the entirety of the island, as opposed to just for 26 counties, back in 1921, yeah.
Exactly, yes. With the partition of the country, we had pro-partition Republicans and anti-partition Republicans, and some of them were led by Owen Duffy. These would be the people who were in favour of a temporary partitioning of Ireland, but they went off to fight with the fascists in Spain. I mean, Christy Moore sings the song, the International Brigade song, and part of the lyrics are, you know, the bishops bless the blue shirts in Dunleary as they sail under the swastika of Spain. So we have had fascist connections, the same as there was when you had Oswald in Britain, you had Owen Duffy in Ireland. And I saw on social media over the weekend that there was another anti-mask protest in London. Mm. And someone unfurled the British, it was the British fascist flag that Mosley had used. And it's like, it's a flag, and in the center, there's like, you know, the symbol for the SS, the two symbols. Right. Yeah. Say? This was one symbol. It was the British National Party or something. And apparently it hasn't been seen in public for like, you know, 70 years or 80 years or longer. So the far right in America is mirrored by the far right in Poland and in Hungary and in Britain. And there is a rise of the far right and a repetition in my mind of the circumstances and the economic circumstances of the haves and have-nots from the 1920s and the 1930s, that was the forerunner to the capitalist Second World War, you know. So I genuinely believe we are in that territory. Whether or not it evolves into something more remains to be seen.
In terms of the Great Depression we're now in, especially here, but where the government is so incompetent in terms of trying to deal with a collapsing economy. Like, I mean, many of the European countries are doing a bit better with this, but one of the other parallels that I think when you mention what an obvious sort of racist and bigot Trump is, like at the same time as things are descending into this more and more violence when there's protests happening here, and Trump is goading it on, and it's also reminiscent of the late 60s, early 70s in Northern Ireland with the government there being so completely, blatantly anti-Catholic, and with putting out blatantly false propaganda that's very reminiscent of Fox propaganda today. That's just totally irrational vilification, and the stuff that goes out on Twitter. I mean, there's still, I mean, the capacity for people to put out fake news that then gets picked up by all kinds of crazy folks on on the streets who believe this stuff. Like this, it's there's more parallels there, it seems like. I don't know, it's not a question so much as
Well, you can see there's a propaganda war. I mean, what did they say? What did Goebbels and Hitler and people say? You know, the bigger the lie, the more chance there is that people will believe it. I mean, the mainstream media is being used. The mainstream media has probably always been used to create consensus for what the government wants to do. So whatever the government wants to do, they go through the media, plant their stories in order to control the public narrative. But I do feel that probably in the last 20 years, society here in Ireland has moved very much to the right. It has become, first it moved into the centre, but the centre itself has actually moved to the right. And I think we're becoming a more materialistic, selfish society where less and less people care or even know much about their neighbours or their community or what's happening. We've had an explosion of homelessness, food banks. The capitalist system that has destroyed America is now destroying Europe.
When we it's very much the case in Ireland, isn't it, with the private landlords and, I mean, and then all these contradictions within the society where many of the private landlords, as far as I know, are Irish, and they're also benefiting from the situation that so many other Irish people and so many immigrants in Ireland are suffering from. And even like tech workers or tech, you know, really well-paid programmers and stuff trying to find a place to live in Cork. Mm-hmm. I've been hearing just nightmares about the housing situation for both Irish and immigrants. But then it must be such a strange, contradictory hotbed kind of thing, like it is anywhere with this, what I call rich peasants and poor peasants, because you end up with a situation where some people there, of those Irish folks, who are benefiting from the fact that they happen to own a house that they maybe bought, two generations ago for a nice reasonable price, but now you can't find a house like that. Very, very familiar to hear. Yeah. And that must be, I mean, I would imagine it's only a matter of time before a lot of people just are looking for answers obviously a lot of people are looking for answers on the left, and Sinn Féin has just done better in the Republican than they've done in decades, right, in terms of electoral politics. But at the same time, I'm not at all surprised to hear about a growing right wing, and I've heard some other things about this too, It's not surprising when you have so many people who can barely afford to live. Some of them are going to look at immigrants as the problem. And I thought maybe Irish people were somehow immune to doing that, but of course they're not.
Yes. I'm always amazed and saddened when I meet people from people living in different parts of the world who were born in Ireland and then emigrated for work purposes or whatever, became immigrants to a host nation, and then become bigots within that nation. I've met Irish people who went to Australia and talk about the Aborigines, they'll steal your car, they're all alcoholics. They fall into this kind of white European trap that somehow that us white Europeans or the civilized people and everyone else is very far from that. But you're talking about the lack of affordable housing, because that's supply and demand. It's a capitalist system. There's not enough housing. Demand increases, and therefore the price reflects that. I've always felt that you're 100% correct that landlords are exploiting this portion of the public concern around housing. But surely it's the state must build affordable housing or place rent caps on the private landlords. The state can't just say, we don't have the money, or we don't have the political willpower, or we do not intend to build public housing. So if you're holding down two jobs in order to survive, you will never be in a position where you can go to a bank and get a mortgage and buy a property. And here, mortgages are always cheaper than rent. So if you can afford $600 a month rent, your mortgage will be $400. But if you don't have the 10% deposit, you don't have the secure employment, you don't have a good credit history, you'll never get it. And basically, the state, through abandoning the process of building public housing, is condemning people who cannot afford their own home to rent in perpetuity. And so long as that's the case, the private landlord will step into this gap in the market and they will exploit the situation because they're trying to make as much money as they can. So I've always felt, outside of building proper housing for its citizens, rent cap must be the way forward for affordable housing, so that people aren't just surviving, but people have somewhere to live and a quality of life that's being denied by the system. And just all the ills that we see, to my mind, are a reflection of a failure of the political will to tackle the inequalities in society, because they just don't care, man. They're too busy, you know, courting the lobbyists, getting finance, getting sponsors for their campaigns, taking brown envelopes and filling their boots with public money. And just on the very last thing, on the rise of fascism across Europe, we all know that what they do is they say it's the immigrants who take the houses, it's the immigrants who take the school places, it's the immigrants who come along and have emergency operations and large families and whatever. They're the reason why your daughter can't get a house, your child can't get a place in the school. Like, we know all this is untrue, and it's a tool that's used by the right to create a false enemy and a false fear. But I believe that there are financial backers now for some of these people who are fronting these organizations, the people who are prepared to take out the video, to go to the courthouse, to get arrested, to become a victim, to say that the state is victimizing them because of their views. People like Tommy Robinson have a lot of money and they have, excuse me, expensive private houses. Tommy Robinson isn't living in a council flat in London. I mean,
this is a far right leader in England.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. He's been in several parties. He claimed to have been on holiday recently in Spain, and someone approached him and kind of harassed him, called him out for being a racist when he was with his family. And now he says he feels so harassed, he thinks he might go and live in Spain. And this is the man who refuses to let refugees come from Iraq or Syria or Yemen to Britain for safe refuge from a war-torn society, but who himself claims victimhood and says he might have to go and live in Spain. The irony that he would become an immigrant and go and live in Spain is obviously lost on him. But I feel it's not just people sitting in a room going, you know, we have to do something to defend the patriotic nationalism of our country. I think this is driven much like the protests in Belarus and Minsk, and the protests you had in the Ukraine and all the color revolutions. People are taking domestic political upheaval and using it for their own imperialist, right-wing, pro-corporation agendas where, you know, to divide the people in order to steal the wealth.
And just to say, you're tuned to Discussions with David, which goes out live every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. in Belfast, on the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance, KABU Community Radio, and elsewhere. You can find it in podcast form if you look for This Week with David Rovics on any podcasting platform, as well as at patreon.com/DavidRovics and at davidrovics.com. There's something about the experience of growing up in Belfast and with divide and conquer politics being basically front and center all the time, from the cradle to the grave, that helps inform your ability to see divide and conquer politics being employed in other situations. Yeah.
Yes. 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 I mean, the parallels. I could have been born as an African American, and I think I would have lived a similar type life. Actually, I probably have a better life than a lot of African Americans, to be fair, because of the repression that they suffer from day and daily. If I was a Palestinian born in the West Bank, I think I would be able to empathize with the Native Americans, with the Irish. So any race that's been colonized and oppressed, the Aborigines, the Inuits, the Native Americans, I mean, all these people... Are the people that I identify with.
You just, for the people that aren't familiar, you know, you grew up in Ardoyne, right? Did you?
I grew up in the Clipperville Road, North Belfast. It's not a million miles.
What was it? Were you in a surrounded neighborhood, or what was it like walking to school in the morning for you?
I can give you, see, we'll have a wee bit of time. I can give you a quick resume and maybe a few enlightening stories of...
Yeah, would you?
No, 100%. Yep. Look, I was born in 1963. So when the violence erupted in 1969, which, I mean, I'm happy to go into the whole background, but I don't want to maybe bore people listening who may already have a good understanding of the politics of what happened here. But if we talk briefly about partition, I mean, you mentioned 1920, 1921, the formation of the two states. What we had were, my history as I was growing up would be one that would say that, like, where I lived in the north of Ireland was the occupied six counties. We were England's first colony, and we have been living under military occupation for 800 years, part of which, they didn't criminalize, but, you know, they marginalized Irish culture, Irish language, Irish music, Irish dance. The fact that 95% or 96% of people in Ireland today speak English isn't because it's a universal language, it's because it was beaten out of us at schools and we weren't allowed to speak it. So when I grew up, when I was 6 or 7, I grew up in a family where politics wouldn't really have been spoken of. I mean, I would have been 11 or 12 before I would have been coming to that age, or coming of age, where you're starting to look around and start to really see the reality of your life. So 1969, we had the civil rights, the civil democratic call for reform from the state. And this was met with violent repression from both the state, which at the time was a one-party unionist pro-British government. So I would have just started primary school, okay? But it would really be in secondary school when I was 11 or 12, when I went to St. Patrick's, also known as Barnagia, the Windy Gap in Gaelic, on the Antrim Road, which was a secondary school. I started there when I was about 12. And like many people becoming a teenager, you spent more and more time out of the house than in the house. So when you're young, you, I don't know, you're playing, you're watching cartoons. When you had 11, 12, 13, you're starting to mature. You have your own friends and you have your own interests outside of the house. So that would start taking me in around 1974, 1975. Now, I'll give you a couple of examples of what it was like when I grew up. I have often used the analogy that I felt like I was a living person living inside a pinball machine. Hmm. Because I could walk 1 mile from my front door in a northerly direction before I came to what we would know as an interface, which you'll have those between the different communities in America. And our interface was between the Catholic Irish Republican community, of which I'm a member, and the Loyalist Orange Unionist British community. Okay, now you literally could take your life in your hands if you were in the wrong place at the wrong time. So I could like walk 1 mile in one direction, 3/4 of a mile in another direction, 1/2 mile in another direction. So from my front door, I could walk, if I was going to walk in a circle, I could walk a maximum of 15 minutes in any one direction before I had to physically stop, like the pinball, like the ball on the pinball machine, and be bounced off in a different direction. Now, I started to follow Cliftonville football team, so the local soccer team. And it was the only team at that time that was based in a nationalist Catholic Republican area. So it was like about 7 minutes from where I lived. I lived on the Cliftonville Road. The football team's called Cliftonville Football and Athletic Club. We started following the Cliftonville football team, which meant we went to about 14 other football grounds. Every one of those other football grounds, including our local derby against Crusaders, was in a pro-British area. So what we had were young nationalists who couldn't fly the Irish flag, but we had our Cliftonville scarves, we had our badges, we had our songs, we sang rebel songs, we sung songs of independence, we sung songs of resistance. We were at times beaten by the police. We were at times attacked by other football fans and other football groups. One example was we were in a final with another league team at the local derby ground. So not our ground, but a ground that's about 20 minutes from where I lived. So we would walk down en masse. We couldn't like drift down in twos and threes because you'd be frightened of being beat up. We would go down in hundreds because the team was very successful. We had a lot of support. We would go down the main road, 200 or 300 of us. And we would be shouting, you know, up the Provos and IRA slogans and everything all the way down to the game. This one particular match, there were 5,000 fans in total at the game. And there were 1,000 police officers detailed to do security at the ground. And about a year later, I was visiting my brother in Manchester. And I went to see Manchester United play Coventry in the before the English Premier League. And they had, I think it was 500 police officers for 37,000 fans. And that's where we were going. Now, where are we living that we need one police officer for every 5 football fans to deter violence? And even then there were darts thrown onto the pitch and it was crazy. So as a young nationalist following one particular football team that identified who I was, the scarf in itself was an indication of your politics, never mind your religion. We had a group, so we had the Republicans engaged in a national war of liberation. Then we had counter-revolutionaries who had colluded with the state. They were like death squads whose sole raison d'etre was to assassinate Republicans, nationalists, and Catholics. Sometimes, a lot of the times, it was just random drive-by shooting. So I'll give you just one or two examples. When I was growing up, very few homes had like a colour television in the early 70s, very few cars in the street, very few private telephones. So when I wanted to keep in contact with family members that had moved to England for work and for education, I would go to the local phone box. So I was in the phone box about a 4-minute walk from my home one evening. You must remember, like, there were sectarian killers stalking the streets of Belfast. And North Belfast, where I grew up, was called the Murder Mile because it was a 1-mile section of which my home was kind of part of the epicentre and a few other streets where it was very, very, very dangerous for Roman Catholics to be out walking alone at night. So in the winter, it's dark at 4 o'clock. You know, I used to go out with a friend and I used to have my Wrangler jeans on, and my DM boots, and my Wrangler jacket on, and my Cliftonville bar scarf. And we sat in our area, in our district. And a couple of these stories are, one night I went to use the phone and I'd left the phone box by about 5 minutes, and a neighbour was using the phone box when people come up in a car and they shot him in the back of the head. Now, he survived. And he actually became a lecturer at Queen's University in Belfast. But That could have been me 5 minutes earlier. You know, that could have been me walking to or from the telephone box because these guys are driving around. Another example is, I personally believe that Republicans were dedicated revolutionaries. I have no doubt that that is the only way to describe them. But the counter-revolutionaries, as in so many conflicts, are sometimes just armed thugs, not very well educated, working on behalf of the state, full of this nationalist patriotism. It's very difficult to know what they're in favour of, but very easy to know what they're against. So if you're for United Ireland, they're against United Ireland. If you're for inclusive society, they're against inclusive society. So these counter-revolutionary gangs.
And if you're for Palestine, they're for Israel, which is also a very interesting contradiction I want to talk about in a while. But
yeah. 100%, yes. Because all the parallels are there. Well, Israel is a colonial settler state, and these people here that I'm referring to are colonial settlers from 400 years ago.
Yeah.
So there was a horrendous group of brutal people called the Shankill Butchers. I think they murdered a total of 19 people in a space of, I'm not a historian, I'm going to say maybe 6 years. Now, their MO was to travel about by car, usually a black taxi, like a black hackney cab, and they would lift some random stranger off the street, a Catholic, because you denote people's religion and possibly their politics from where they live, because we lived in a very segregated area. So if this happened to a black person, you say it's racist straight away. This is a group of four white men attacking and murdering a black person. I'm white. I've got blue eyes. I speak English. I have a Belfast accent. You don't know my politics. You know nothing about me because I look exactly like my Protestant pro-British unionist neighbour. But because of the demarcation of the violence and people lived in segregated areas, you knew from the area you were in and traveling through who lived there. So a friend and I were sitting, I lived near a park, it was called the Waterworks. At the bottom of my street, there's a park. The park maybe might go a mile this way and maybe a quarter of a mile this way and then a mile again. So it's kind of a square shape. And we used to go down onto the main road because that's the only place we could see people, cars driving about, people on the bus, people coming home from work. So I am maybe 15 years of age in, say, 1978. And I have on my uniform, as I said, the Wranglers and the DMs and a football scarf. And I'm sitting on a wall of a shop which is closed because a lot of people at a certain time in the evening, you would just suddenly notice, David, where'd everybody go? There's people going to the shops, people traveling back from work, people going to visit friends and family, maybe nipping to the bar or the off license or a convenience store. And then all of a sudden you look around and you go, ooh, where is everybody? It's a bit eerie. It's a bit, maybe we're out too late. You know, there was no curfew, but we all had our own personal curfew at a time that we thought, right, it's not safe to be in the streets. So we were sitting on the windowsill, myself and my friend, and a car passed. And they shouted up the UVF. Now, that's the Ulster Volunteer Force. So, like, I'm 15. I walked out onto the road and I shouted up Provost as I drove down the road, you see. Yikes. Now, the car had no lights on, but I stood. So I had moved from the footpath onto the road and I was watching the car continue to traverse down the road. And then I saw the no indicators that it was turning left or right, but I saw the brake lights come on. Because I lived in the area, I said to my friend, they're turning up the Aya Street. So we have the park here. Let me see. The park's here, and we're on the main road. And the car gone down and was turning and was going to come up parallel. It was basically going to do a U-turn, not on the main road, but go up a side street and come back around. So I said to my friend, I said, I think they're coming back. We better go here. So we walked down the Antrim Road about, say, 20 metres and turned right into Brookvale Avenue. And as we turned right into Brookvale Avenue, the car came along Brook Hill Avenue at the junction. So as we walked around the park, the car pulled up, two doors opened, two guys got out of the car, and me and my friend are jumping over the railings into the park. And I hesitated and looked behind me just to see if they were coming. And you could see the guys running towards the fence where we were. We started running in the park and we looked over his shoulder and I could see the silhouette of these two guys up on top of the fence, ready to come into the park after us. And I must say, I mean, my heart was like, it was going like a little chaffinch or a little bird. It was beating that fast. And I heard somebody shout, "Stand down, stand down." And I went away. We hid in the park for over an hour before we went safe enough to go the last 30 meters from the park to our front door. We waited and waited and waited and waited. Then we climbed over the railings and then we run up the road and we run into the house. And that's a story that my friend and myself have, and there are probably many, many others of people who escaped possible kidnapping and torture, because what the Shankill Butchers did was they kidnapped people off the street and then they brutally tortured them with butcher's knives. That's why they were called the Butchers. They took the people to an area beside like a loyalist drinking den where people were drinking alcohol. It's presumed that the bar was closed and they would take the people in round the back. They hung them up on like a meat hook. And the reason why we know this isn't only how people died, because they were slashed with the knives and eventually their throat was slit. And then, the bodies were found semi-naked sometimes in Glencairn, in a loyalist area just outside of North Belfast. And the headlines in the paper would be, or on the radio or on the news, latest victim of the Shankill Butchers. But the very last guy that they had, they must have thought he was dead whenever they cut his throat. I hope this isn't too graphic, but instead of holding his head up, his head was down. So they didn't actually sever the arteries. So when they dumped his body, he was found. Mm. And the police said that he died. And they were able to put him, after some hospitalization, in a car and drove him up the Shankill Road. And because these people, like serial killers, had intended killing him, they never wore any masks, and he was able to identify the killers. Mm. Went to jail for something like 906 years in total. And they were all released under the Good Friday Agreement. So there's two short cameos of one person living in North Belfast in an area that would have been, where I lived, there were over 800, there's something like 3,200, I think, victims of the Troubles, and maybe and thousands more injured. So there's the number who died and the number who were injured. And I believe over 800 of them died within 1 square mile of my front door. That would have been the police, British Army, Republicans, ordinary Catholic nationalists, some loyalists.
So you'd say that again? How close to your front door?
No, within one mile of my front door.
About 800 of them, of those 3,000
of the fatalities, yes. Yeah. The worst years were 72 to 78. That's when the things would have been at their height, when we had Bloody Friday and different things.
When you were a secondary school student, middle school and high school.
There was a Republican who was convicted in Britain and was put in a British jail, and his name was Frank Stagg. He was a hunger striker. And I think he died in 1974 or 76. I was in school, and we actually tried en masse, the school pupils, to break out of the school because we wanted to go down. And today you would say show solidarity with the family, but then we wanted to go down and rat with the British Army. We wanted to go down and show our displeasure towards the state at how it was treating our people when he died in, it might have been Brixton Prison, I'm not 100% sure, but when he died, we all tried to en masse leave the school, and the teachers had their straps and they were all lined up with the school gates trying to prevent this kids scurrying under their legs and under their arms and over the fences to get out. So we would have There's a lot of history here, Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily good history. No one should ever have to fight for their freedom and for their liberty. But an oppressor never wakes up one morning, has a cup of coffee, and says, "Hey, you know what? We should give these people back their freedom." And the black African Americans will never get equality. I don't think they'll ever get it in America. To be fair and to be honest, as an outsider, I think they have to. I think they not only have to fight for it, I can't understand. You have the same duopoly in politics that we have. You have two parties that ostensibly claim left and right politics. or one's
ostensibly
liberal.
Right. It's
a facade. Yeah. It's a mirage. It's not true. You have two parties that are both extremely wing and corporate driven.
Speaking of that, would you say in your circles in Belfast was Jeremy Corbyn's candidacy or potential, I guess he was the leader of the Labour Party for a while, and I know that the Labour Party isn't necessarily popular among the sorts of folks who would vote for Labour in Belfast are probably voting for Sinn Féin, right? But was Corbyn a phenomenon there, a hopeful sign at all?
I met Jeremy Corbyn and got the obligatory selfie with him. I used to have it as my picture on the Facebook. I met him at a festival in West Belfast before he became leader of the Labour Party. Look, I'm a socialist. I believe that we should have a fair distribution of wealth within society. I don't believe anyone should not have free education, free healthcare, free housing if it's possible. There's enough wealth in the world to allow all these things to come about. So on a personal level, I would have been a very, very, very big fan of Jeremy Corbyn's policies. And the policies that he put forward when he did become the leader of the Labour Party was the perfect antidote to neoliberal austerity. Whenever the government is taking money away from public services, the antidote is to put money in the public services in order to create better conditions in the health service and for education and for housing and all the things we've touched upon. I'm on the left, okay? See when I was growing up, when Sinn Féin, my first vote was in 1982. So you had the hunger strikes in 1981 and the election of Bobby Sands and Kieran Dougherty and other people to the British and Irish parliaments. But I was born in 1963, so I didn't become 18 until 1981. And, there weren't elections until 1982. I voted for Joe Wasson for Sinn Féin in 1982 because Sinn Féin spoke about a democratic socialist republic. So I'm not claiming that I had a defined socialist political view, worldview when I was 18, but I believed in the democratic socialist republic. So I would support Jeremy Corbyn, but there are a lot of people, and Sinn Féin publicly would claim to support Jeremy Corbyn, and perhaps they do, but Sinn Féin have dropped the whole idea of having a socialist republic in Ireland, north or south. I have gone from someone who voted Sinn Féin as my first party of choice at the age of 19 in 1982, all the way through to electioneering on their behalf for Gerry Kelly. Gerry Kelly was an MLA, ex-hunger striker himself.
MLA?
MLA? Yes, in the Assembly.
What's that?
Oh, sorry, it's a member of the Legislative Assembly, so that's the devolved regional government of Northern Ireland. So, I mean, this guy was in hunger strike in Brixton Prison. He was involved in all types of armed militant resistance of the British occupation of Ireland. And I electioneered for Gerry in two elections. I electioneered in the councils on behalf of Sinn Féin. The closer I actually politically came, or physically came to Sinn Féin, the more I realised that it's a nationalist party. It's a nationalist party that wants a republic, but it's not a socialist party.
It's running more on that platform in the republic, on more socialist principles in terms of like housing, affordable housing, and that's why people seem to be voting for it in such large numbers, unprecedented numbers in the republic, yeah. Yes. I mean, it seems there is this weird divide between Republican the Sinn Féin in the Republic of Ireland and the Sinn Féin in the six counties. When you were running for office, you were running for office as an independent recently, and when I was looking you up this morning online and just snooping around beyond your blog and looking at just what comes up when you look for you online, you were running for office under these kinds of socialist this kind of socialist platform against austerity and for housing and healthcare and this sort of thing. The first thing that you come up with, other than stuff about your campaign, are your critics, who are not criticizing you on the basis of your platform, but just trying to figure out basically which camp you come from. Are you from a nationalist or a loyalist background? As if your campaign platform is irrelevant, and all that's relevant is basically whether you're a Catholic or a Protestant. It was really like this guy was his orientation, clearly a loyalist, from some kind of paramilitary loyalist orientation, and this guy's position, which was an interesting way that he worded it, because it was like, for readers who agree with him, it's so self-explanatory. His position is so self-explanatory that he doesn't really need to go into any detail. All he needs to do is say, whatever Frahues said he was running on, look, we have evidence here that he's a Catholic, so don't trust him. You know, it's like, whoa, yeah.
There's an old joke, maybe you shouldn't say it, but if I can remember it, yes, I mean, the history here is very much one of, I have a thousand stories. Everybody has. Do you know what I mean? And no matter who you are, where you're born, you've lived life to a certain age. You're gonna pick up life lessons or things that happened in life. So, I was explaining there how I actually fought on behalf of the Republican political movement to help get Sinn Féin elected into the government here in the north of Ireland, because I believed in the rhetoric of the Socialist Republic. The closer I got to Sinn Féin, the more I realized it's not a socialist party, and therefore it no longer represented me. So when I looked down the ballot, I could see unionist, nationalist, because that's what Sinn Féin are. They're a nationalist party. They can't say they're anything else. And liberals and whatever. So I went all the way down, and I thought, there's no one represents me. There's no one I can vote for. And then I thought, well, I'm not alone. There must be loads of people who aren't necessarily socialist, but have no one on the ballot to vote for. So I ran unsuccessfully in several elections as an independent socialist anti-austerity candidate. But, you know, I helped bring that debate out into the public domain, the debate which should be about class, not about national identity. The national identity, I'm a socialist. That makes me a Republican. That makes me in favour of the end of partition and the reunification of my country, and that everyone, Protestant, Catholic, Unionist and Nationalist, should be treated equally under the Constitution. And if we have a written Constitution, we can guarantee the rights of everyone. So I did run as an independent. And here's a quick wee story. My sister was up at Belfast Castle walking her dog. And obviously in the election, you put your posters up on the elections. And someone who works for the council got into conversation with my sister. And he said, not knowing my sister was my sister, he said to her, and you see that Fry Hughes? He's nothing but a Republican, blah, 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 blah. So what you're saying is correct. It's not about my class politics or defense of the working class and the promotion of socialist values. It's everybody's opinion. Everybody's a Republican, because I am a Fenian and I am a Republican, but that doesn't define. It helps define my politics, but it isn't the entirety of my politics. But that's what happens. You know, they demonize people in order to marginalize them, so you have less and less of an opportunity to have your views heard in the public domain. And just lastly, listen, I'm really, really, really glad what you've mentioned about Sinn Féin. I'm not anti-Sinn Féin, but I think it's very important to say what I'm going to say and the opportunity that you've given me. Because Sinn Féin in the north of Ireland, their slogan is about national reunification. We'll carry on the fight that the men on hunger strike died for, the fight that the men and the women went to prison for, the fight that we all continue today to end the sin of partition that was visited upon the Irish people by the British government, British guns, British Navy and the British Air Force, must come to an end. Okay, so I'm 100% behind that. We must end partition. But what kind of government do you want once you end partition? James Connolly, who led the Irish Citizens' Army in 1916 in the rebellion, to paraphrase what he said, if you take down the British flag today and you put up an Irish flag, but you don't change the system of government, which is basically landlords, capitalists, and corporations, all you will have changed is the flag. And if I had a political slogan, that's what that would be. Now, you've said that down south, that Sinn Féin, there's this dichotomy of a nationalist, and they are centre to centre-right Sinn Féin, in my opinion. You have this nationalist Sinn Féin in the north, but you have a soft left Sinn Féin in the south. Now, to me, this is a perfect example of what is wrong with democracy all over the West. Sinn Féin is positioning itself on the left in the Irish Free State in order to win votes, in order to become electable, in order to gain power and form a government. They are not on the left, as far as I'm concerned. Again, there are socialists in Sinn Féin, but Sinn Féin is not a socialist party. So you look at all that ails the Irish people and the economy. So you say, housing rent is mad. It's ridiculous. You know, so we should have rent caps, or we must build. How many times have you heard a politician say, we'll get into power and we will build 100,000 public housing units in the next 5 years? What they're doing is they're taking all the issues that people have with the failures of the state. People look at Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael and say, we voted them in for the last 100 years. What have we got? Doubling of rent, whatever it happens to be. Yeah. So people look for an alternative. Sinn Féin and others position themselves as the alternative to say, hey, give us a try. Let us try and change the system on your behalf.
Sure.
Now, what will happen, David, is, and again, I would, when we're talking about houses, I would put my house on this. They will get into power and they will change from the party in opposition that makes all the promises to sort out all the problems in society. They'll get your vote. They'll lie to you. Not just Sinn Féin, like all the parties do. They'll lie to you. They'll deceive you. And they'll seduce you to get your vote. They'll get into power. Then I don't believe the system is reformable under any circumstances. I think the people who go in who say they will reform the system, become part of the system, 20 years later, they are the very thing that they stood outside that parliament 20 years ago and said, we must have change. These people have failed us. We must get them out. I have no doubt if Sinn Féin got into power tomorrow, we will have no real noticeable difference in 5, 10, 15 or 20 years' time. They were a revolutionary military organization who are now a constitutional political party. And as such, there'll be no change because the system is irreformable. So we must smash the system and replace it with something that's in the interest of the people and not in the interest of the parties. And that's one thing I used to say to people on the door when I was electioneering. I said, when you vote for a party, the party will do what's in the interest of the party because that's what they do. Whereas if you elect someone who's an independent, that person will try and reflect your concerns and your interests rather than the interests of the party. So people say to me, oh, Sinn Féin, and I hope I'm not going on too long about this, but just one perfect example is Syriza.
Mm-hmm.
Syriza in Greece promised, I mean, they are a proper, a real leftist party as far as I'm concerned. They went in and I met a lady who was a cabinet minister in Syriza who resigned in disgust at
a bunch of people resigned when they sort of went back on their...
And they have a new party. But that just shows you, you know, when the opportunity is there for change by a radical left party, they didn't do it. And if Jeremy Corbyn had been elected, you know, I think he might have died. He might have been found dead in his sleep with a massive heart attack or something. So don't believe the state would really have allowed... The deep state or the secret state or whatever's running, what's really running government in the background, will only allow so much of a variation in a spectrum between left and right politically before they step in and do something about it. So,
and anybody ever accuse you of being cynical, Fra?
Once or twice.
I
genuinely do. I think the blinkers have gone off and I'm seeing things in real terms and man, I am shocked and frightened at just how disposable we are as people to the people in power. They care nothing for us, nothing.
When did you first travel to another colonized country?
Palestine. I went with, after that Operation Cast Lead in the December, January of 2009, I went with George Galloway and about eight other Irish guys to Gaza on the Viva Palestina 5 aid convoy. And we went through, I don't know, 11 countries, and it took 30-odd days. And we were in Syria for 16 days in Latakia in the Palestine refugee camp, waiting for Mubarak at the time to give permission for us to travel to Gaza. And I believe that's when I first met you, David, in when you were singing in Belfast in the Roddy McCordy's Club. And I had just, I believe I'd just come back from Gaza.
Right.
And during the break, I was able to get up and talk about the adventure, which is what it was. And I've been, and from that, I mean, that was Gaza 2010. Then I've been to the West Bank on three occasions. I was in the West Bank in 2000 and maybe 18. Is that when they moved the American embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem?
Yeah, I think so.
Yep, because I'm an activist, and I thought, what can I do to support the Palestinian people? So rather than wave a flag at the city hall, I got on a plane, flew to Tel Aviv, got the bus or got the joint taxis, the whatever they're called, up to Bethlehem. And then I protested on the day that the American embassy was officially opened in Jerusalem. And I've been to the World Federation Trade Union Conference in Damascus on two occasions. And I've been in Beirut at the Palestine summer camp. So I've been to Beirut. Been to Beirut three times. I've been to Syria five times in total over the years because it was on two convoys. Been to Gaza once. I've been to the West Bank on three separate occasions. And I was in Venezuela last August. And I was at Chavez Mausoleum up in the hills. I was on a food sovereignty delegation. I'm just saying this because as an activist, if you decide you're going to do something, all the things I've done are acts of solidarity, David. I haven't done anything thinking I'm personally going to change the world or I'm some hero who's going to go over there. You know, you're treated like a hero in some instances because
it's just people, for showing up, right? I got an award every town I went to in Palestine, not because anybody liked my music, but it's like, hey, he's here, he's playing music. Did out of all the different places.
Beside someone and face what they're facing. That's how I look at it.
Yeah.
Even for a day or a week or a month to do that, that's true solidarity, you know.
And of all those places that you mentioned that you've been to, I'm guessing that the place that was most reminiscent of your childhood in Belfast was the West Bank.
Yes.
Is that right?
I thought you might say Jerusalem because that's what came into my mind straight away, the Damascus Gate, because we had checkpoints coming in at the Belfast City.
Jerusalem, yeah.
And that military brutalization of the Palestinian people is just we never suffered anything like that, thankfully. See, to be fair,
even Desmond Tutu from South Africa, he says this is way worse than anything we had in South Africa.
And they would know about it, yes. South Africa is actually leading the BDS movement in many respects, the global BDS movement at the minute.
Yeah.
People who have that affinity and that empathy are the very people who should. I'm surprised there isn't more contact between African Americans and the Palestinian diaspora, but also
there has been. There has been quite a bit, but there's also a lot of propaganda against against Palestinians that people get fed here. But Angela Davis is wonderfully outspoken, eloquent supporter of the Palestinians.
I met her in Belfast a few years ago.
Ah, great.
Over an economic form, yeah.
Great. Well, next time we'll spend more time talking about the Middle East, but this has been just wonderful, Fra. Thanks so much for joining me for the show. Yeah.
Hopefully the next time you're in Ireland, we'll be able to hear you sing again, and hopefully it won't be too long. I've always been a great admirer of your lyrics. I really have. That's you and Paul McAdam, I know you know Paul. You're the only two people I know whose hearts and souls are not only in their music, but your politics is there, your love of humanity, and your disgust at the inequalities in life. And like some of the songs, you have that song Janine, and you have Troy, is it Troy Davies? and a few other ones.
That's Paul McAdam, the one about Troy Davis, which is a okay. really amazing song.
Yes. But you have Janine, and you've got so many. You've got Oil, and you've got the Resistance song, and the Kiss Behind the Barricade, and you've a few songs about here, and you've songs about the miners and stuff in America. Your stuff's fabulous because you're telling a story through your lyrics, so that people who are unaware of it can actually step back and go, right, so that's what that's about, or that's what that happens. So keep at it, man, you know.
In the Irish tradition.
Yes.
Thanks so much for... Huh? No, it is. I mean, we so much of the music that I grew, you know, that I am into is originated from that island over there. And that storytelling tradition. Not that it's, you know, unique to Ireland, but
of course.
See you again, Fra. Thanks so much for joining me. Take care.
You. See you soon.
And thanks everybody for tuning into this conversation with Fra Hughes. You can find all of these discussions archived in various places, including on my YouTube channel at youtube.com/drovix in the Discussions with David playlist. You'll also find them all in podcast form if you look for This Week with David Rovix on any podcasting platform, or just go to davidrovix.com or get the David Rovix mobile app. If you want to support my broadcasting efforts, you're most welcome to become a patron at patreon.com/davidrovix, where all these broadcasts are also available for anyone to download, along with some patron-only offerings as well. If you're in the Portland area, please go to artistsforrentcontrol.org and sign up to receive text notifications so you can be part of Portland Emergency Eviction Response when the investment banks that own half this city start trying to evict so many of our neighbors. Remember, don't pay the rent. Don't be afraid of your neighbors. Mutual aid will get us through. Bye for now.